When people needed evidence to support something they had learned, they would bring a printout with them to the relevant meeting, content that everyone they showed it to would understand its meaning. Auditable. When informed that their pet project is a failure, most of us are tempted to blame the messenger, the data, the manager, the gods, or anything else we can think of. That's why the third A of good metrics, auditable, is so essential. We must ensure that the data is metrics, auditable, is so essential. We must ensure that the data is credible to employees. The employees at Imvu would brandish one-page reports to demonstrate what they had learned to settle arguments, but the process often wasn't so smooth. Most of the time, when a manager, developer, or team was confronted with results that would kill a pet project, the loser of the argument would challenge the veracity of the data. Such challenges are more common than most managers would admit, and unfortunately, most data reporting systems are not designed to answer them successfully. Sometimes this is the result of a well-intentioned but misplaced desire to protect the privacy of customers. More often, the lack of such supporting documentation is simply a matter of neglect. Most data reporting systems are not built by product development teams, whose job is to prioritize and build product features. They are built by business managers and analysts. Managers who must use these systems can only check to see if the reports are mutually consistent. They all too often lack a way to test if the data is consistent with reality. The solution. First, remember that metrics are people, too. We need to be able to test the data by hand, in the messy real world, by talking to customers. This is the only way to be able to check if the reports contain true facts. Managers need the ability to spot check the data with real customers. It also has a second BT:: systems that provide this level of auditability give managers and entrepreneurs the opportunity to gain insights into why customers are behaving the way the data indicate. Second, those building reports must make sure the mechanisms that generate the reports are not too complex. Whenever possible, reports should be drawn directly from the master data, rather than from an intermediate system, which reduces opportunities for error. I have noticed that every time a team has one of its judgments or assumptions overturned as a result of a technical problem with the data, its confidence, morale, and discipline are undermined. When we watch entrepreneurs succeed in the myth-making world of Hollywood, books, and magazines, the story is always structured the same way. First, we see the plucky protagonist having an epiphany, hatching a great new idea. We learn about his or her character and personality, how he or she came to be in the right place at the right time, and how he or she took the dramatic leap to start a business. Then the photo montage begins. It's usually short, just a few minutes of time-lapse photography or narrative. We see the protagonist building a team, maybe working in a lab, writing on whiteboards, closing sales, pounding on a few keyboards. At the end of the montage, the founders are successful, and the story can move on to more interesting fare: how to split the spoils of their success, who will appear on magazine covers, who sues whom, and implications for the future. Unfortunately, the real work that determines the success of startups happens during the photo montage. It doesn't make the cut in terms of the big story because it is too boring. Only 5% of entrepreneurship is the big idea, the business model, the whiteboard strategizing, and the splitting up of the spoils. The other 95% is the gritty work that is measured by innovation accounting, product priorities, RTO decisions, deciding which customers to target or listen to, and having the courage to subject a grand vision to constant testing and feedback. One decision stands out above all others as the most difficult, the most time-consuming, and the biggest source of waste for most startups. We all must face this fundamental test, deciding when to pivot and when to persevere. To understand what happens during the photo montage, we have to understand how to pivot, and that is the subject of Chapter 8. E8 Pivot, or Persevere. Very entrepreneur eventually faces an overriding challenge in developing a successful product, deciding when to pivot and when to persevere. Everything that has been discussed so far is a prelude to a seemingly simple question: are we making suicide progress to believe that our original strategic hypothesis is correct, or do we need to make a major change? That change is called a pivot, a structured course correction designed to test a new fundamental hypothesis about the product, strategy, and engine of growth. Because of the Xietai-C methodology that underlies the lean startup, there is often a misconception that it offers a rigid clinical formula for making pivot or persevere decisions. This is not true. There is no way to remove the human element, vision, intuition, judgment, from the practice of entrepreneurship, nor would that be desirable. My goal in advocating a Xietai-C approach to the creation of startups is to channel human creativity into its most productive form, and there is no bigger destroyer of creative potential than the misguided decision to persevere. Companies that cannot bring themselves to pivot to a new direction on the basis of feedback from the marketplace can get stuck in the land of the living dead, neither growing enough nor dying, consuming resources and commitment from employees and other stakeholders but not moving ahead. There is good news about our reliance on judgment, though. We are able to learn, we are innately creative, and we have a remarkable ability to see the signal in the noise. In fact, we are so good at this that sometimes we see signals that aren't there. The heart of the Xietai-C method is the realization that although human judgment may be faulty, we can improve our judgment by subjecting our theories to repeated testing. Startup productivity is not about cranking out more widgets or features. It is about aligning our efforts with a business and product that are working to create value and drive growth. In other words, successful pivots put us on a path toward growing a sustainable business. Innovation accounting leads to faster pivots. To see this process in action, meet David Biretti, the CEO of Votazi. David has had a long career helping to bring the American political process into the 21st century. In the early 1980s, he helped build USA.gov, the RST portal for the federal government. He's also experienced some classic startup failures. When it came time to build Votazi, David was determined to avoid betting the farm on his vision. David wanted to tackle the problem of civic participation in the political process. His RST product concept was a social network of very ed voters, a place where people passionate about civic causes could get together, share ideas, and recruit their friends. David built his first minimum viable product for just over $1,200 in about 3 months and launched it. David wasn't building something that nobody wanted. In fact, from its earliest days, Votazi was able to attract early adopters who loved the core concept. Like all entrepreneurs, David had to re-northeast his product and business model. What made David's challenge especially hard was that he had to make those pivots in the face of moderate success. David's initial concept involved four big leaps of faith. 1. Customers would be interested enough in the social network to sign up. Registration. 2. Votazi would be able to verify them as registered voters. Activation. 3. Customers who were very ed voters would engage with the site's activism tools over time. Retention. 4. Engaged customers would tell their friends about the service and recruit them into civic causes. Referral. 3 months and $1,200 later, David's RST MVP was in customers' hands. In the initial cohorts, 5% signed up for the service and 17% verified their registered voter status, see the chart below. The numbers were so low that there wasn't enough data to tell what sort of engagement or referral would occur. It was time to start iterating. Initial MVP registration 5% activation 17% retention too low referral too low. David spent the next 2 months and another $5,000 split testing new product features, messaging, and improving the product's design to make it easier to use. Those tests showed dramatic improvements, going from a 5% registration rate to 17% and from a 17% activation rate to over 90%. Such is the power of split testing. This optimization gave David a critical mass of customers with which to measure the next two leaps of faith. However, as shown in the chart below, those numbers proved to be even more discouraging. David achieved a referral rate of only 4% and a retention rate of 5%. Initial MVP after optimization registration 5% 17% activation 17% 90% retention too low 5% referral too low 4%. David knew he had to do more development and testing. For the next 3 months he continued to optimize, split test, and re-northeast his pitch. He talked to customers, held focus groups, and did countless of /B experiments. As was explained in Chapter 7, in a split test, different versions of a product are aired to different customers at the same time. By observing the changes in behavior between the two groups, one can make inferences about the impact of the different variations. As shown in the chart below, the referral rate nudged up slightly to 6% and the retention rate went up to 8%. A disappointed David had spent 8 months and $20,000 to build a product that wasn't living up to the growth model he'd hoped for. Before optimization after optimization registration 17% 17% activation 90% 90% retention 5% 8% referral 4% 6% David faced the DI cult challenge of deciding whether to pivot or persevere. This is one of the hardest decisions entrepreneurs face. The goal of creating learning milestones is not to make the decision. The goal of creating learning milestones is not to make the decision easy, it is to make sure that there is relevant data in the room when it comes time to decide. Remember, at this point David has had many customer conversations. He has plenty of learning that he can use to rationalize the failure he has experienced with the current product. That's exactly what many entrepreneurs do. In Silicon Valley, we call this experience getting stuck in the land of the living dead. It happens when a company has achieved a modicum of success, just enough to stay alive, but is not living up to the expectations of its founders and investors. Such companies are a terrible drain of human energy. Out of loyalty, the employees and founders don't want to give in. They feel that success might be just around the corner. David had two advantages that helped him avoid this fate. 1. Despite being committed to a gigantic vision, he had done his best to launch early and iterate. Thus, he was facing a pivot or persevere moment just 8 months into the life of his company. The more money, time, and creative energy that has been sunk into an idea, the harder it is to pivot. David had done well to avoid that trap. 2. David had identified his leap of faith questions explicitly at the outset and, more important, had made quantitative predictions about each of them. It would not have been DI cult for him to declare success retroactively from that initial venture. After all, some of his metrics, such as activation, were doing quite well. In terms of gross metrics such as total usage, the company had positive growth. It is only because David focused on actionable metrics for each of his leap of faith questions that he was able to accept that his company was failing. In addition, because David had not wasted energy on premature PR, he was able to make this determination without public embarrassment or distraction. Failure is a prerequisite to learning. The problem with the notion of shipping a product and then seeing what happens is that you are of shipping a product and then seeing what happens is that you are guaranteed to succeed at seeing what happens. But then what? As soon as you have a handful of customers, you're likely to have VE opinions about what to do next. Which should you listen to? Votizee's results were okay, but they were not good enough. David felt that although his optimization was improving the metrics, they were not trending toward a model that would sustain the business overall. But like all good entrepreneurs, he did not give up prematurely. David decided to pivot and test a new hypothesis. A pivot requires that we keep one foot rooted in what we've learned so far, while making a fundamental change in strategy in order to seek even greater validated learning. In this case, David's direct contact with customers proved essential. He had heard three recurring bits of feedback in his testing. 1. I always wanted to get more involved. This makes it so much easier. 2. The fact that you prove I'm a voter matters. 3. There's no one here. What's the point of coming back? 1. David decided to undertake what I call a zoom-in pivot, refocusing the product on what previously had been considered just one feature of a larger whole. Think of the customer comments above. Customers like the concept. They like the voter registration technology, but they aren't getting value out of the social networking part of the product. David decided to change Votizee into a product called At2Gov, a social lobbying platform. Rather than get customers integrated in a civic social network, At2Gov allows them to contact their elected representatives quickly and easily via existing social networks such as Twitter. The customer engages digitally, but At2Gov translates that digital contact into paper form. Members of Congress receive old-fashioned printed letters and petitions as a result. In other words, At2Gov translates the high-tech world of its customers into the low-tech world of politics. At2Gov had a slightly different set of leap of faith questions to At2Gov had a slightly different set of leap of faith questions to answer. It still depended on customers signing up, verifying their voter status, and referring their friends, but the growth model changed. Instead of relying on an engagement-driven business, sticky growth, At2Gov was more transactional. David's hypothesis was that passionate activists would be willing to pay money to have At2Gov facilitate contacts on behalf of voters who cared about their issues. David's new MVP took 4 months and another $30,000. He'd now spent a grand total of $50,000 and worked for 12 months. But the results from his next round of testing were dramatic. Registration rate 42%. Activation 83%, retention 21%, and referral a whopping 54%. However, the number of activists willing to pay was less than 1%. The value of each transaction was far too low to sustain a pro-table business even after David had done his best to optimize it. Before we get to David's next pivot, notice how convincingly he was able to demonstrate validated learning. He hoped that with this new product, he would be able to improve his leap of faith metrics dramatically, and he did. See the chart below. Before pivot after pivot engine of growth sticky paid registration rate 17%, 42% activation 90%, 83% retention 8%, 21% referral 6%, 54% revenue n/a 1% lifetime value, LTV. n/a minimal. He did this not by working harder but by working smarter. Taking he did this not by working harder but by working smarter. Taking his product development resources and applying them to a new and different product. Compared with the previous 4 months of optimization, the new 4 months of pivoting had resulted in a dramatically higher return on investment, but David was still stuck in an age-old entrepreneurial trap. His metrics and product were improving, but not fast enough. David pivoted again. This time, rather than rely on activists to pay money to drive contacts, he went to large organizations, professional fundraisers, and big companies, which all have a professional or business interest in political campaigning. The companies seemed extremely eager to use and pay for David's service, and David quickly signed letters of intent to build the functionality they needed. In this pivot, David did what I call a customer segment pivot, keeping the functionality of the product the same but changing the audience focus. He focused on who pays, from consumers to businesses and operating organizations. In other words, David went from being a business to consumer, B2 degrees Celsius, company to being a business to business, B2B, company. In the process he changed his planned growth model, as well to one where he would be able to fund growth out of the proceeds generated from each B2B sale. 3 months later, David had built the functionality he had promised, based on those early letters of intent. But when he went back to companies to collect his checks, he discovered more problems. Company after company procrastinated, delayed, and ultimately passed up the opportunity. Although they had been excited enough to sign a letter of intent, closing a real sale was much more difficult. It turned out that those companies were not early adopters. On the basis of the letters of intent, David had increased his headcount, taking on additional sales staff and engineers in anticipation of having to service higher margin business-to-business accounts. When the sales didn't materialize, the whole team had to work harder to try to end revenue elsewhere. Yet no matter how many sales calls they went on and no matter how much optimization they did to the product, the model wasn't working. Returning to his leap of faith questions, David concluded that the results refuted his business-to-business hypothesis, and so he decided to pivot once again. All this time, David was learning and gaining feedback from his potential customers, but he was in an unsustainable situation. You can't pay staff with what you've learned, and raising money at that juncture would have escalated the problem. Raising money without early traction is not a certain thing. If he had been able to raise money, he could have kept the company going but would have been pouring money into a value-destroying engine of growth. He would be in a high-pressure situation, use investors' cash to make the engine of growth work or risk having to shut down the company, or be replaced. David decided to reduce staff and pivot again, this time attempting what I call a platform pivot. Instead of selling an application to one customer at a time, David envisioned a new growth model inspired by Google's AdWords platform. He built a self-serve sales platform where anyone could become a customer with just a credit card. Thus, no matter what cause you were passionate about, you could go to AdTwoGov's website and AdTwoGov would help you ND new people to get involved. As always, the new people were very ad-registered voters, and so their opinions carried weight with elected officials. The new product took only one additional month to build and immediately showed results, 51% sign-up rate, 92% activation rate, 28% retention rate, 64% referral rate, see the chart below. Most important, 11% of these customers were willing to pay 20 cents per message. Most important, this was the beginning of an actual growth model that could work. Receiving 20 cents per message might not sound like much, but the high referral rate meant that At2Gov could grow its tracy without spending significant marketing money. This is the viral engine of growth. Before pivot, after pivot, engine of growth paid viral registration rate 42%, 51% activation, 83%, 92% retention, 21%, 28% referral, 54%, 64% revenue, 1%, 11% lifetime value, LTV, minimal 20 cents per message. Voters' ease story exhibits some common patterns. One of the most important to note is the acceleration of MVPs. The RST MVP took 8 months, the next 4 months, then 3, then 1. Each time David was able to validate or refute his next hypothesis faster than before. How can one explain this acceleration? It is tempting to credit it to the product development work that had been going on. Many features had been created, and with them a fair amount of infrastructure. Therefore, each time the company pivoted, it didn't have to start from scratch. But this is not the whole story. For one thing, much of the product had to be discarded between pivots. Worse, the product that remained was classified as a legacy product, one that was no longer suited to the goals of the company. As is usually the case, the EOT required to reform a legacy product took extra work. Counteracting these forces were the hard-won lessons David had learned through each milestone. Voters' ease accelerated its MVP process because it was learning critical things about its customers, market, and strategy. Today, 2 years after its inception, voters' ease is doing well. They recently raised $1.5 million from Facebook's initial investor Peter Thiel, one of the very few consumer internet investments he has made in recent years. Voters' ease system now can process voter identity in real time for 47 states, representing 94% of identity in real time for 47 states, representing 94% of the U.S. population, and has delivered tens of thousands of messages to Congress. The Startup Visa campaign used Voters' ease tools to introduce the Startup Visa Act, S-565. Which is the RST legislation introduced into the Senate solely as a result of social lobbying. These activities have attracted the attention of established Washington consultants who are seeking to employ voters' ease tools in future political campaigns. David Biretti sums up his experience building a lean startup. In 2003, I started a company in roughly the same space as I'm in today. I had roughly the same domain expertise and industry credibility, fresh over the USA.gov success. But back then my company was a total failure, despite consuming significantly greater investment, while now I have a business making money and closing deals. Back then I did the traditional linear product development model, releasing an amazing product. It really was, after 12 months of development, only to end that no one would buy it. This time I produced 4 versions in 12 weeks and generated my RST sale relatively soon after that. And it isn't just market timing. 2 other companies that launched in a similar space in 2003 subsequently sold for tens of millions of dollars, and others in 2010 followed a linear model straight to the dead pool. A startup's runway is the number of pivots it can still make. Seasoned entrepreneurs often speak of the runway that their startup has left, the amount of time remaining in which a startup must either achieve lift or fail. This usually is denoted as the remaining cash in the bank divided by the monthly burn rate, or net drain on that account balance. For example, a startup with $1 million in the bank that is spending $100,000 per month has a projected runway of 10 months. Projected runway of 10 months. When startups start to run low on cash, they can extend the runway 2 ways, by cutting costs or by raising additional funds. But when entrepreneurs cut costs indiscriminately, they are as liable to cut the costs that are allowing the company to get through its build, measure, learn feedback loop as they are to cut waste. If the cuts result in a slowdown to this feedback loop, all they have accomplished is to help the startup go out of business more slowly. The true measure of runway is how many pivots a startup has left, the number of opportunities it has to make a fundamental change to its business strategy. Measuring runway through the lens of pivots rather than that of time suggests another way to extend that runway, get to each pivot faster. In other words, the startup has to find ways to achieve the same amount of validated learning at lower cost or in a shorter time. All the techniques in the lean startup model that have been discussed so far have this as their overarching goal. Pivots require courage. Ask most entrepreneurs who have decided to pivot and they will tell you that they wish they had made the decision sooner. I believe there are three reasons why this happens. First, vanity metrics can allow entrepreneurs to form false conclusions and live in their own private reality. This is particularly damaging to the decision to pivot because it robs teams of the belief that it is necessary to change. When people are forced to change against their better judgment, the process is harder, takes longer, and leads to a less decisive outcome. Second, when an entrepreneur has an unclear hypothesis, it's almost impossible to experience complete failure, and without failure there is usually no impetus to embark on the radical change a pivot requires. As I mentioned earlier, the failure of the launch it and see what happens approach should now be evident. You will always succeed in seeing what happens. Except in rare cases, the early results will be ambiguous, and you won't know whether to early results will be ambiguous. And you won't know whether to pivot or persevere, whether to change direction or stay the course. Third, many entrepreneurs are afraid. Acknowledging failure can lead to dangerously low morale. Most entrepreneurs' biggest fear is not that their vision will prove to be wrong. More terrifying is the thought that the vision might be deemed wrong without having been given a real chance to prove itself. This fear drives much of the resistance to the minimum viable product, split testing, and other techniques to test hypotheses. Ironically, this fear drives up the risk because testing doesn't occur until the vision is fully represented. However, by that time it is often too late to pivot because funding is running out. To avoid this fate, entrepreneurs need to face their fears and be willing to fail, often in a public way. In fact, entrepreneurs who have a high profile, either because of personal fame or because they are operating as part of a famous brand, face an extreme version of this problem. A new startup in Silicon Valley called Path was started by experienced entrepreneurs, Dave Morey, who previously had overseen Facebook's platform initiative, Dustin Mirow, product designer and Kaka Atta of Maxter, and Sean Fanning of Arbster fame. They decided to release a minimum viable product in 2010. Because of the high-profile nature of its founders, the MVP attracted significant press attention, especially from technology and startup blogs. Unfortunately, their product was not targeted at technology early adopters, and as a result, the early blogger reaction was quite negative. Many entrepreneurs fail to launch because they are afraid of this kind of reaction, worrying that it will harm the morale of the entire company. The allure of positive press, especially in our home industry, is quite strong. Luckily, the Path team had the courage to ignore this fear and focus on what their customers said. As a result, they were able to get essential early feedback from actual customers. Path's goal is to create a more personal social network that maintains its quality over time. Many people have had the experience of being overcorrected on existing social networks, sharing with past co-workers, high school friends, relatives, and colleagues. Such broad groups make it hard to share intimate moments. Path-token groups make it hard to share intimate moments. Path took an unusual approach. For example, it limited the number of connections to FTY, based on brain research by the anthropologist Robin Dunbar at Oxford. His research suggests that FTY is roughly the number of personal relationships in any person's life at any given time. For members of the tech press, and many tech early adopters, this artificial constraint on the number of connections was anathema. They routinely use new social networking products with thousands of connections. 50 seemed way too small. As a result, Path endured a lot of public criticism, which was hard to ignore. But customers locked to the platform, and their feedback was decidedly different from the negativity in the press. Customers liked the intimate moments and consistently wanted features that were not on the original product roadmap, such as the ability to share how friends' pictures made them feel and the ability to share video moments. Dave Morey summed up his experience this way: "The reality of our team and our backgrounds built up a massive wall of expectations. I don't think it would have mattered what we would have released. We would have been met with expectations that are hard to live up to. But to us it just meant we needed to get our product and our vision out into the market broadly in order to get feedback and to begin iteration. We humbly test our theories and our approach to see what the market thinks. Listen to feedback honestly. And continue to innovate in the directions we think will create meaning in the world." Path's story is just beginning, but already their courage in facing down critics is paying off. If and when they need to pivot, they won't be hampered by fear. They recently raised $8.5 million in venture capital in a round led by Kleiner Perkins Coie LLD and Bias. In doing so, Path reportedly turned down an acquisition offer for $100 million from Google. To the pivot or persevere meeting, the decision to pivot requires a clear-eyed and objective mindset. We've discussed the telltale signs of the need to pivot, the decreasing effectiveness of product experiments and the general feeling that product development should be more productive. Whenever you see those symptoms, consider a pivot. The decision to pivot is emotionally charged for any startup and has to be addressed in a structured way. One way to mitigate this challenge is to schedule the meeting in advance. I recommend that every startup have a regular pivot or persevere meeting. In my experience, less than a few weeks between meetings is too often and more than a few months is too infrequent. However, each startup needs to find its own pace. Each pivot or persevere meeting requires the participation of both the product development and business leadership teams. At ImVue, we also added the perspectives of outside advisors who could help us see past our preconceptions and interpret data in new ways. The product development team must bring a complete report of the results of its product optimization efforts over time, not just the past period, as well as a comparison of how those results stack up against expectations, again, over time. The business leadership should bring detailed accounts of their conversations with current and potential customers. Let's take a look at this process in action in a dramatic pivot done by a company called Wealthfront. That company was founded in 2007 by Dan Carroll and added Andy Rattle as CEO shortly thereafter. Andy is a well-known guru in Silicon Valley. He is a co-founder and former general partner of the venture capital room Benchmark Capital and is on the faculty of the Stanford Graduate School of Business, where he teaches a variety of courses on technology entrepreneurship. I first met Andy when he commissioned a case study on ImVue to teach his students about the process we had used to build the company. Wealthfront's mission is to disrupt the mutual fund industry by bringing greater transparency, access, and value to retail investors. Bringing greater transparency, access, and value to retail investors. What makes Wealthfront's story unusual, however, is not where it is today but how it began, as an online game. In Wealthfrot's original incarnation it was called Kaishig and was conceived as a kind of fantasy league for amateur investors. It allowed anyone to open a virtual trading account and build a portfolio that was based on real market data without having to invest real money. The idea was to identify diamonds in the rough, amateur traders who lacked the resources to become fund managers but who possessed market insight. Wealthfrot's founders did not want to be in the online gaming business per selenium. Kaishig was part of a sophisticated strategy in the service of their larger vision. Any student of disruptive innovation would have looked on approvingly. They were following that system perfectly by initially serving customers who were unable to participate in the mainstream market. Over time, they believed, the product would become more and more sophisticated, eventually allowing users to serve and disrupt existing professional fund managers. To identify the best amateur trading savants, Wealthfrot built sophisticated technology to rate the skill of each fund manager, using techniques employed by the most sophisticated evaluators of money managers, the premier U.S. university endowments. Those methods allowed them to evaluate not just the returns the managers generated but also the amount of risk they had taken along with how consistent they performed relative to their declared investment strategy. Thus, fund managers who achieved great returns through reckless gambles, i.e., investments outside their area of expertise, would be ranked lower than those who had figured out how to beat the market through skill. With its Kaishig game, Wealthfrot hoped to test two leap-of-faith assumptions. 1. A significant percentage of the game players would demonstrate enough talent as virtual fund managers to prove themselves suitable to become managers of real assets, the value hypothesis. Value hypothesis. 2. The game would grow using the viral engine of growth and generate value using a freemium business model. The game was free to play, but the team hoped that a percentage of the players would realize that they were lousy traders and therefore want to convert to paying customers. Once Wealthfrot started offering real asset management services, the growth hypothesis. Kaishig was a huge early success, attracting more than 450,000 gamers in its initial launch. By now, you should be suspicious of this kind of vanity metric. Many less disciplined companies would have celebrated that success and felt their future was secure, but Wealthfrot had identified its assumptions clearly and was able to think more rigorously. By the time Wealthfrot was ready to launch its paidational product, only 7 amateur managers had qualified as worthy of managing other people's money, far less than the ideal model had anticipated. After the paid product launched, they were able to measure the conversion rate of gamers into paying customers. Here too the numbers were discouraging, the conversion rate was close to zero. Their model had predicted that hundreds of customers would sign up, but only 14 did. The team worked valiantly to find ways to improve the product, but none showed any particular promise. It was time for a pivot or persevere meeting. If the data we have discussed so far was all that was available at that critical meeting, Wealthfrot would have been in trouble. They would have known that their current strategy wasn't working but not what to do to exit. That is why it was critical that they followed the recommendation earlier in this chapter to investigate alternative possibilities. In this case, Wealthfrot had pursued two important lines of inquiry. The RST was a series of conversations with professional money managers, beginning with John Powers, the head of Stanford University's endowment, who reacted surprisingly positively. Wealthfrot's strategy was premised on the assumption that professional money managers would be reluctant to join the system. Professional money managers would be reluctant to join the system because the increased transparency would threaten their sense of authority. Powers had no such concerns. CEO Andy Rackel then began a series of conversations with other professional investment managers and brought the results back to the company. His insights were as follows. 1. Successful professional money managers felt they had nothing to fear from transparency, since they believed it would validate their skills. 2. Money managers faced significant challenges in managing and scaling their own businesses. They were hampered by the difficulty of servicing their own accounts and therefore had to require high minimum investments as a way to screen new clients. The second problem was so severe that wealth fraud was LDIG cold calls from professional managers asking out of the blue to join the platform. These were classic early adopters who had the vision to see past the current product to something they could use to achieve a competitive advantage. The second critical qualitative information came out of conversations with consumers. It turned out that they found the blending of virtual and real portfolio management on the KAShig website confusing. Far from being a clever way of acquiring customers, the freemium strategy was getting in the way by promoting confusion about the company's positioning. This data informed the pivot or persevere meeting. With everyone present, the team debated what to do with its future. The current strategy wasn't working, but many employees were nervous about abandoning the online game. After all, it was an important part of what they had signed on to build. They had invested significant time and energy building and supporting those customers. It was painful, as it always is, to realize that energy had been wasted. Wealthfront decided it could not persevere as it existed. The company chose instead to celebrate what it had learned. If it had not launched its current product, the team never would have learned what it needed to know to pivot. In fact, the experience taught them something essential about their vision. As Andy says, what we really wanted to change was not who manages the money but who has access to the best possible talent. We'd originally thought we'd need to build a significant business with amateur managers to get professionals to come on board, but fortunately it turns out that wasn't necessary. The company pivoted, abandoning the gaming customers altogether and focusing on providing a service that allowed customers to invest with professional managers. On the surface, the pivot seems quite dramatic in that the company changed its positioning, its name, and its partner strategy. It even jettisoned a large proportion of the features it had built. But at its core, a surprising amount stayed the same. The most valuable work the company had done was building technology to evaluate managers' effectiveness, and this became the kernel around which the new business was built. This is also common with pivots. It is not necessary to throw out everything that came before and start over. Instead, it's about repurposing what has been built and what has been learned to find a more positive direction. Today, Wealthfront is prospering as a result of its pivot, with over $180 million invested on the platform and more than 40 professional managers. 3. It recently was named one of Fast Company's 10 most innovative companies in Nance. 4. The company continues to operate with agility, scaling in line with the growth principles outlined in Chapter 12. Wealthfront is also a leading advocate of the development technique known as continuous deployment, which we'll discuss in Chapter 9. Failure to pivot. The decision to pivot is so difficult that many companies fail to make it. I wish I could say that every time I was confronted with the need to pivot, I handled it well, but this is far from true. I remember one failure to pivot especially well. A few years after Imvu's founding, the company was having tremendous success. The business had grown to over $1 million per month in revenue. We had created more than 20 million avatars for our customers. We managed to raise significant new rounds of financing, and like the global economy, We were riding high. But danger lurked around the corner. Unknowingly, we had fallen into a classic startup trap. We had been so successful with our early eorts that we were ignoring the principles behind them. As a result, we missed the need to pivot even as it stared us in the face. We had built an organization that excelled at the kinds of activities described in earlier chapters, creating minimum viable products to test new ideas and running experiments to tune the engine of growth. Before we had begun to enjoy success, many people had advised against our low-quality minimum viable product and experimental approach, urging us to slow down. They wanted us to do things right and focus on quality instead of speed. We ignored that advice, mostly because we wanted to claim the advantages of speed. After our approach was vindicated, the advice we received changed. Now most of the advice we heard was that you can't argue with success, urging us to stay the course. We liked this advice better, but it was equally wrong. Remember that the rationale for building low-quality MVPs is that developing any features beyond what early adopters require is a form of waste. However, the logic of this takes you only so far. Once you have found success with early adopters, you want to sell to mainstream customers. Mainstream customers have different requirements and are much more demanding. The kind of pivot we needed is called a customer segment pivot. In this pivot, the company realizes that the product it's building solves a real problem for real customers but that they are not the customers it originally planned to serve. In other words, the product hypothesis is confirmed only partially. This chapter described such a pivot in the Votazi story, above. A customer segment pivot is an especially tricky pivot to execute. A customer segment pivot is an especially tricky pivot to execute because, as we learned the hard way at Imvu, the very actions that made us successful with early adopters were diametrically opposed to the actions we'd have to master to be successful with mainstream customers. We lacked a clear understanding of how our engine of growth operated. We had begun to trust our vanity metrics. We had stopped using learning milestones to hold ourselves accountable. Instead, it was much more convenient to focus on the ever larger gross metrics that were so exciting, breaking new records in signing up paying customers and active users, monitoring our customer retention rate, you name it. Under the surface, it should have been clear that our efforts at tuning the engine were reaching diminishing returns, the classic sign of the need to pivot. For example, we spent months trying to improve the product's activation rate, the rate at which new customers become active consumers of the product, which remained stubbornly low. We did countless experiments, usability improvements, new persuasion techniques, incentive programs, customer quests, and other games-like features. Individually, many of these new features and new marketing tools were successful. We measured them rigorously, using a / B experimentation. But taken in aggregate, over the course of many months, we were seeing negligible changes in the overall drivers of our engine of growth. Even our activation rate, which had been the center of our focus, edged up only a few percentage points. We ignored the signs because the company was still growing, delivering month after month of up and to the right results. But we were quickly exhausting our early adopter market. It was getting harder and harder to ND customers we could acquire at the prices we were accustomed to paying. As we drove our marketing team to ND more customers, they were forced to reach out more to mainstream customers, but mainstream customers are less forgiving of an early product. The activation and METIS RTO rates of new customers started to go down, driving up the cost of acquiring new customers. Pretty soon, our growth was 8 lag and our engine sputtered and stalled. It took us far too long to make the changes necessary to X this. It took us far too long to make the changes necessary to X this situation. As with all pivots, we had to get back to basics and start the innovation accounting cycle over. It felt like the company's second founding. We had gotten really good at optimizing, tuning, and iterating, but in the process we had lost sight of the purpose of those activities, testing a clear hypothesis in the service of the company's vision. Instead, we were chasing growth, revenue, and profits wherever we could find them. We needed to reacquaint IT ourselves with our new mainstream customers. Our interaction designers led the way by developing a clear customer archetype that was based on extensive in-person conversations and observation. Next, we needed to invest heavily in a major product overhaul designed to make the product dramatically easier to use. Because of our overfocus on Northeast tuning, we had stopped making large investments like these, preferring to invest in lower risk and lower yield testing experiments. However, investing in quality, design, and larger projects did not require that we abandon our experimental roots. On the contrary, once we realized our mistake and executed the pivot, those skills served us well. We created a sandbox for experimentation like the one described in Chapter 12 and had a cross-functional team work exclusively on this major redesign. As they built, they continuously tested their new design head-to-head against the old one. Initially, the new design performed worse than the old one, as is usually the case. It lacked the features and functionality of the old design and had many new mistakes as well. But the team relentlessly improved the design until, months later, it performed better. This new design laid the foundation for our future growth. This foundation has paid off handsomely. By 2009, revenue had more than doubled to over $25 million annually. But we might have enjoyed that success earlier if we had pivoted sooner. 5. A catalogue of pivots. Pivots come in different avias. The word pivot sometimes is used incorrectly as a synonym for change. A pivot is a special kind of incorrectly as a synonym for change. A pivot is a special kind of change designed to test a new fundamental hypothesis about the product, business model, and engine of growth. Zoom in pivot. In this case, what previously was considered a single feature in a product becomes the whole product. This is the type of pivot Votazi made when it pivoted away from a full social network and toward a simple voter contact product. Zoom out pivot. In the reverse situation, sometimes a single feature is isolated to support a whole product. In this type of pivot, what was considered the whole product becomes a single feature of a much larger product. Customer segment pivot. In this pivot, the company realizes that the product it is building solves a real problem for real customers but that they are not the type of customers it originally planned to serve. In other words, the product hypothesis is partially con-armed, solving the right problem, but for a different customer than originally anticipated. Customer need pivot. As a result of getting to know customers extremely well, it sometimes becomes clear that the problem we are trying to solve for them is not very important. However, because of this customer intimacy, we often discover other related problems that are important and can be solved by our team. In many cases, these related problems may require little more than repositioning. The related problems may require little more than repositioning the existing product. In other cases, it may require a completely new product. Again, this is a case where the product hypothesis is partially con-armed. The target customer has a problem worth solving, just not the one that was originally anticipated. A famous example is the chain Potbelly sandwich shop, which today has over 200 stores. It began as an antique store in 1977. The owners started to sell sandwiches as a way to bolster traffic to their stores. Pretty soon they had pivoted their way into an entirely different line of business. Platform pivot. A platform pivot refers to a change from an application to a platform or vice versa. Most commonly, startups that aspire to create a new platform begin life by selling a single application, the so-called killer app, for their platform. Only later does the platform emerge as a vehicle for third parties to leverage as a way to create their own related products. However, this order is not always set in stone, and some companies have to execute this pivot multiple times. Business architecture pivot. This pivot borrows a concept from Geoffrey Moore, who observed that companies generally follow one of two major business architectures: high margin, low volume, complex systems model, or low margin, high volume, volume operations model. 6. The former commonly is associated with business to business, B2B, or enterprise sales cycles, and the latter with consumer products. There are notable exceptions. In a business architecture pivot, a startup switches architectures. Some companies change from high margin, low volume by going mass market, for example, Google's search appliance. Others, originally designed for the mass market, turned out to require long and expensive sales cycles. Value capture pivot. There are many ways to capture the value a company creates. These methods are referred to commonly as METES, RTO, or revenue models. These terms are much too limiting. Implicit in the idea of METES RTO is that it is a separate feature of a product that can be added or removed at will. In reality, capturing value is an intrinsic part of the product hypothesis. Often, changes to the way a company captures value can have far-reaching consequences for the rest of the business, product, and marketing strategies. Engine of growth pivot. As we'll see in Chapter 10, there are three primary engines of growth that power startups: the viral, sticky, and paid growth models. In this type of pivot, a company changes its growth strategy to seek faster or more profitable growth. Commonly, but not always, the engine of growth also requires a change in the way value is captured. Channel pivot. In traditional sales terminology, the mechanism by which a company delivers its product to customers is called the sales channel or distribution channel. For example, consumer packaged goods are sold in a grocery store, cars are sold in dealerships, and much enterprise software is sold, with extensive customization, by consulting and professional services, RMS. Often, the requirements of the channel determine the price, features, and competitive landscape of a product. A channel pivot is a recognition that the same basic solution could be delivered through a different channel with greater effectiveness. Whenever a company abandons a previously complex sales process to sell direct to its end users, a channel pivot is in progress. Channel pivot is in progress. It is precisely because of its destructive effect on sales channels that the internet has had such a disruptive influence in industries that previously required complex sales and distribution channels, such as newspaper, magazine, and book publishing. Technology pivot. Occasionally, a company discovers a way to achieve the same solution by using a completely different technology. Technology pivots are much more common in established businesses. In other words, they are a sustaining innovation, an incremental improvement designed to appeal to and retain an existing customer base. Established companies excel at this kind of pivot because so much is not changing. The customer segment is the same, the customer's problem is the same, the value capture model is the same, and the channel partners are the same. The only question is whether the new technology can provide superior price and forward/or performance compared with the existing technology. A pivot is a strategic hypothesis, although the pivots identified above will be familiar to students of business strategy. The ability to pivot is no substitute for sound strategic thinking. The problem with providing famous examples of pivots is that most people are familiar only with the successful end strategies of famous companies. Most readers know that Southwest or Walmart is an example of a low-cost disruption in their markets, that Microsoft an example of a platform monopoly, and that Starbucks has leveraged a powerful premium brand. What is generally less well known are the pivots that were required to discover those strategies. Companies have a strong incentive to align their PR stories around the heroic founder and make it seem that their success was the inevitable result of a good idea. Thus, although startups often pivot into a strategy that seems thus, although startups often pivot into a strategy that seems similar to that of a successful company, it is important not to put too much stock in these analogies. It's extremely difficult to know if the analogy has been drawn properly. Have we copied the essential features or just superficial ones? Will what worked in that industry work in ours? Will what has worked in the past work today? A pivot is better understood as a new strategic hypothesis that will require a new minimum viable product to test. Pivots are a permanent fact of life for any growing business. Even after a company achieves initial success, it must continue to pivot. Those familiar with the technology life cycle ideas of theorists such as Geoffrey Moore know certain later stage pivots by the names he has given them: the chasm, the tornado, the bowling alley. Readers of the disruptive innovation literature spearheaded by Harvard's Clayton Christers will be familiar with established companies that fail to pivot when they should. The critical skill for managers today is to match those theories to their present situation so that they apply the right advice at the right time. Modern managers cannot have escaped the deluge of recent books calling on them to adapt, change, reinvent, or upend their existing businesses. Many of the works in this category are long on exhortations and short on specifics. A pivot is not just an exhortation to change. Remember, it is a special kind of structured change designed to test a new fundamental hypothesis about the product, business model, and engine of growth. It is the heart of the lean startup method. It is what makes the companies that follow lean startup resilient in the face of mistakes. If we take a wrong turn, we have the tools we need to realize it and the agility to find another path. In part 2, we have looked at a startup idea from its initial leaps of faith, tested it with a minimum viable product, used innovation accounting and actionable metrics to evaluate the results, and made the decision to pivot or persevere. I have treated these subjects in great detail to prepare for what I have treated these subjects in great detail to prepare for what comes next. On the page, these processes may seem clinical, slow, and simple. In the real world, something different is needed. We have learned to steer when moving slowly. Now we must learn to race. Laying a solid foundation is only the first step toward our real destination, acceleration. Part 3 Accelerate Start Your Engines. Most of the decisions startups face are not clear-cut. How often should you release a product? Is there a reason to release weekly rather than daily or quarterly or annually? Product releases incur overhead, and so from an efficiency point of view, releasing often leaves less time to devote to building the product. However, waiting too long to release can lead to the ultimate waste, making something that nobody wants. How much time and energy should companies invest in infrastructure and planning early on in anticipation of success? Spend too much and you waste precious time that could have been spent learning. Spend too little and you may fail to take advantage of early success and cede market leadership to a fast follower. What should employees spend their days doing? How do we hold people accountable for learning at an organizational level? Traditional departments create incentive structures that keep people focused on excellence in their specialties: marketing, sales, product development. But what if the company's best interests are served by cross-functional collaboration? Startups need organizational structures that combat the extreme uncertainty that is a startup's chief enemy. The lean manufacturing movement faced similar questions on the factory floor. Their answers are relevant for startups as well, with some modifications. The critical RST question for any lean transformation is, which activities create value and which are a form of waste. Once you understand this distinction, you can begin using lean techniques to drive out waste and increase the efficiency of the value-creating activities. For these techniques to be used in a startup, they must be adapted to the unique circumstances of entrepreneurship. Recall from Chapter 3 that value in a startup is not the creation of STU, but rather validated learning about how to build a sustainable business. What products do customers really want? How will our business grow? Who is our customer? Which customers should we listen to and which should we ignore? These are the questions that need answering as quickly as possible to maximize a startup's chances of success. That is what creates value for a startup. In Part 3, we will develop techniques that allow lean startups to grow without sacrificing the speed and agility that are the lifeblood of every startup. Contrary to common belief, lethargy and bureaucracy are not the inevitable fate of companies as they achieve maturity. I believe that with the proper foundation, lean startups can grow to become lean enterprises that maintain their agility, learning orientation, and culture of innovation even as they scale. In Chapter 9, we will see how lean startups take advantage of the counterintuitive power of small batches. Just as lean manufacturing has pursued a just-in-time approach to building products, reducing the need for in-process inventory, lean startups practice just-in-time scalability, conducting product experiments without making massive upfront investments in planning and design. Chapter 10 will explore the metrics startups should use to understand their growth as they add new customers and discover new markets. Sustainable growth follows one of three engines of growth: paid, viral, or sticky. By identifying which engine of growth a startup is using, it can then direct energy where it will be most effective in growing the business. Each engine requires a focus on unique metrics to evaluate the success of new products and prioritize new experiments. When used with the innovation accounting method described in Part 2, these metrics allow accounting method described in Part 2. These metrics allow startups to gear out when their growth is at risk of running out and pivot accordingly. Chapter 11 shows how to build an adaptive organization by investing in the right amount of process to keep teams nimble as they grow. We will see how techniques from the toolkit of lean manufacturing, such as the 5 whys, help startup teams grow without becoming bureaucratic or dysfunctional. We also will see how lean disciplines set the stage for a startup to transition into an established company driven by operational excellence. In Chapter 12, we'll come full circle. As startups grow into established companies, they face the same pressures that make it necessary for today's enterprises to endeavor new ways to invest in disruptive innovation. In fact, we'll see that an advantage of a successful startup's rapid growth is that the company can keep its entrepreneurial DNA even as it matures. Today's companies must learn to master a management portfolio of sustainable and disruptive innovation. It is an obsolete view that sees startups as going through discrete phases that leave earlier kinds of work, such as innovation, behind. Rather, modern companies must excel at doing multiple kinds of work in parallel. To do so, we'll explore techniques for incubating innovation teams within the context of an established company. I have included an epilogue called Waste Not, in which I consider some of the broader implications of the success of the lean startup movement, place it in historical context, including cautionary lessons from past movements, and make suggestions for its future direction. I9batch in the book Lean Thinking, James Womack and Daniel Jones recount a story of stewing newsletters into envelopes with the assistance of one of the author's two young children. Every envelope had to be addressed, stamped, to'd with a letter, and sealed. The daughters, age 6 and 9, knew how they should go about completing the project. "Daddy, RST, you should fold all of the newsletters. Then you should attach the seal. Then you should put on the stamps." Their father wanted to do it the counterintuitive way, complete each envelope one at a time. They, like most of us, thought that was backward, explaining to him that wouldn't be efficient. He and his daughters each took half the envelopes and competed to see who would finish first. The father won the race, and not just because he is an adult. It happened because the one envelope at a time approach is a faster way of getting the job done, even though it seems eyesight. This has been confirmed in many studies, including one that was recorded on video. One, the one envelope at a time approach is called single piece OW in lean manufacturing. It works because of the surprising power of small batches. When we do work that proceeds in stages, the batch size refers to how much work moves from one stage to the next at a time. For example, if we were stewing 100 envelopes, the intuitive way to do it, folding 100 letters at a time, would have a batch size of 100. Single piece OW is so named because it has a batch size of 1. Is so named because it has a batch size of 1. Why does stewing one envelope at a time get the job done faster, even though it seems like it would be slower? Because our intuition doesn't take into account the extra time required to sort, stack, and move around the large piles of half-complete envelopes. When it's done the other way too, it seems more efficient to repeat the same task over and over, in part because we expect that we will get better at this simple task the more we do it. Unfortunately, in process-oriented work like this, individual performance is not nearly as important as the overall performance of the system. Even if the amount of time that each process took was exactly the same, the small batch production approach still would be superior, and for even more counterintuitive reasons. For example, imagine that the letters didn't T in the envelopes. With the large batch approach, we wouldn't ND that out until nearly the end. With small batches, we'd know almost immediately. What if the envelopes are defective and won't seal? In the large batch approach, we'd have to stew all the envelopes, get new ones, and re-stew them. In the small batch approach, we'd ND this out immediately and have no rework required. All these issues are visible in a process as simple as string envelopes, but they are of real and much greater consequence in the work of every company, large or small. The small batch approach produces a finished product every few seconds, whereas the large batch approach must deliver all the products at once, at the end. Imagine what this might look like if the time horizon was hours, days, or weeks. What if it turns out that the customers have decided they don't want the product? Which process would allow a company to find this out sooner? Lean manufacturers discovered the BTS of small batches decades ago. In the post-World War II economy, Japanese car makers such as Toyota could not compete with huge American factories that used the latest mass production techniques. Following the intuitively eyesight way of building, mass production factories build cars by using ever larger batch sizes. They would spend huge amounts of money buying machines that could produce car parts by amounts of money buying machines that could produce car parts by the tens, hundreds, or thousands. By keeping those machines running at peak speed, they could drive down the unit cost of each part and produce cars that were incredibly inexpensive so long as they were completely uniform. The Japanese car market was far too small for companies such as Toyota to employ those economies of scale, thus, Japanese companies faced intense pressure from mass production. Also, in the war-ravaged Japanese economy, capital was not available for massive investments in large machines. It was against this backdrop that innovators such as Taiichi Oho, Shiji Oshigo, and others found a way to succeed by using small batches. Instead of buying large specialized machines that could produce thousands.
Thank you for listening to this episode of our podcast. We'll be really thankful if you support us by clicking the link in the description so that we continue to create amazing content for you.